the question I want to take a look at is, can you fulfill the mitzvah of living in Israel in Chicago? So what's the answer?
You're going to need a whole lot more definitions.
Okay, great. Let's define our terms. What term is the definition?
Well, we also got to define whether, what the mitzvah of Yishuv Haaretz is.
Okay, we need to know what it means to fulfill the mitzvah of Yishuv Haaretz. Great. Any other things we need to define or other information that we need?
Does it apply today?
Does it apply today? Fantastic question. I mean, wherever the mitzvah is, it might be irrelevant. So if the mitzvah is irrelevant, I don't even care if I could fulfill that in Chicago and shalom al Yisrael. Okay. Other questions? Anything else that needs to be answered or data we need to fill in?
I mean, you could bring up how some of the mitzvahs that might make this more relevant could also not be plausible nowadays.
Okay, so there's practical plausibility factors. All the things you might think are great ideas, but they're not realistic, and so they're irrelevant. And on the flip side, you could think about all of the mitzvot that are relevant to Israel that are even more plausible nowadays than they have been over the past, years, decades, centuries. Depending on how you expand that time scale, I think you get a very different picture of how plausible some of these mitzvot and some of these participations really are. So what we'll do is basically tackle this in two parts. We'll first look at the mitzvah of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael. This is a very, very surface-level approach to this mitzvah. There's as with many of these topics, hundreds of years of literature kind of fleshing out a lot of the details of the mitzvah, but we'll look at one kind of mainstream classical presentation of what this mitzvah entails and what it looks like. And then we'll see, okay, given those definitions of the mitzvah, there are a couple of things that non-Israeli residents or non-residents of Israel or of Eretz Israel maybe can do, and see whether those meet the criteria of the mitzvah. So we'll start with one of the major classic sources of the mitzvah of Yishuv Eretz Israel, which is this comment of the Ramban in source number one, the mitzvah to live in Israel. First of all, there's a question about this work. This is from the Hasagot, Ramban Sefer HaMitzvot, with the Ramban's glosses or arguments about the Sefer HaMitzvot, which famous Jewish thinker, I mean, there are several, but who are we thinking of most when we think about a Sefer HaMitzvot?
Ramban?
Ramban wrote glosses or, arguments about some aspects of a Sefer HaMitzvot, a book of listing all the commandments, but the most classic version of a Sefer HaMitzvot comes from Rambam. There are funny sketches out there, if anyone who appreciates humor about the Rishonim, which is admittedly a very niche market, so I don't know how they pull it off, but anyone who appreciates humor about the Rishonim, there are sketches about, the Rambam and the Ramban getting confused for one another, and it's exceedingly hilarious to a very niche group of people. So Ramban basically wrote his attacks on the Rambam's list of all the mitzvot, and a part of those attacks involve arguing that some of the things that the Rambam thought were mitzvot actually are not. Okay, so that's a fine thing to do. You could have reasonable debates about what's a mitzvah, what's not a mitzvah, what you thought was a mitzvah but really is just permission to do something, etc. But that's going to leave you with a problem, because how many mitzvot are there? 613. And if you remove some of the mitzvot from the list, what do you have to do? You have to add more, right? You have to compensate. So it's going to be a balancing act. Every mitzvah, I think, doesn't count. I have to discover or apply a new mitzvah. And that's what he's doing here. This is from a section of the book called the Shechichat Asim. Here are all the mitzvot asay that were... What was that?
Sounds like Rebbe chapter.
Well, if you're one of the Rebbe's, you could say I disagree with the other Rebbe, right? Rebbe chapter's for all of us.
I'm saying for people asking for different officers, if your rabbi says no, then if I want a rabbi, says yes.
Right, exactly. But again, Ramban is saying, no, I am the rabbi who says yes. So you have such a thing, right? And especially on the level of what even is a mitzvah, it raises big questions. So what he does here in the Shechichat Asin, all the mitzvot the Rambam forgot to list in his book, I've got you covered. And the fourth one is our main topic today, Mitzvah Ravid, our fourth mitzvah. We're going to read this first paragraph together, and then I'll ask you to tell me what exactly, as precisely as we can, define what we're being commanded to do. This is a mitzvah asay. We're being told a positive mitzvah to do something. What is that mitzvah? Okay, let's read the paragraph and see if we can puzzle out some of the details. Mitzvah Ravit, shenitzavinu l'reshet ha'aretz. The fourth mitzvah is that we are commanded to inherit the land. Asher natan hakel yit barach v'yedale lavotinu l'Avraham l'Yitzchak u'l'Yaakov, that Hashem gave to our forefathers, Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. V'lo ne'ezva b'yad zulatenu min ha'umot o lishmama, and not leave it abandoned in the hands either of other nations or lishmama, meaning desolate. You shouldn't leave the land empty. V'amro lahem, and then you quote the pasuk to support that idea. V'or Hashem et ha'aretz v'yishav temba. Well, you know, you can look at the translation. Ki lachem natati et ha'aretz, ha'reshet ota v'nachaltem et ha'aretz. And then this mitzvah is repeated many times. And then following the ellipsis in the third line, that no place in the land should be abandoned. It should not be left. And this is what our sages call milchemet mitzvah, a mitzvah war. Meaning not a voluntary war that you could choose to do or not do, but a war that fulfills a certain mitzvah. Okay, stopping here for a second. What is entailed by this mitzvah? What are we supposed to do? You could, you know, either try to give me a holistic picture or specific details. What are we picking up on? Yeah.
Based off of this, there's a mitzvah to go out, conquer the land, which would entail you have to have an army to support not only the actual conquest, but to maintain that conquest. So you would have to have that, and then you would also have to thus have like an economy to support that military and have people living in there to be able to keep that afloat.
Okay, so you see three pieces. You see a mitzvah to conquer the land. I'll push in a minute on what conquer means, but we'll get there in a second. A mitzvah to preserve that conquest with an army, and a mitzvah to have an economy to support the army to preserve that conquest. That's what I'm hearing. Okay. Other aspects of the mitzvah, other perspectives on the mitzvah, what else is entailed by this commandment? Okay, so let's push back on the conquest for a second. What does it mean to conquer land? How would you know if you've done it? At what point will you be able to say, like, all right, I finished the mitzvah now, land conquered?
To ensure that no other nations have control of the land. So, for instance, there's a interesting machlokas that is brought down with like Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, where he even says that we haven't fulfilled this mitzvah because we don't have complete control of the land, in the sense that if we went into a Christian quarter and started destroying the sanctuaries there, or went into the airport and started destroying those mosques. Essentially, what we're doing is we're starting World War III. So,
and is that a problem?
I mean, then if you went,
all right, we're going to pause before areas. All the politics. Okay.
Well, went to the Jewish area and started destroying all the fields, people would fight back too.
No, agreed. But we don't have. But what he's saying is,
bring World War III brings the Mashiach anyway.
Yeah, but we don't want to bring Mashiach through that.
We don't want nukes to start flying.
We don't want. Go
everyone
on.
Has a bad.
We don't want to bring Mashiach
through
the Golden
Gate. It's fine.
No!
As much as I'm all for like war crimes, we don't want to bring this up through the door.
Just know everything is being recorded right now. So this is important to put
so
on the record.
It's not going on like YU Torah.
It is absolutely
anything,
going on YU Torah.
Okay. Even better.
Alright, so nobody mentioned who said that statement.
Good, we're not going to talk about it. We're not talking about it. Okay, so conquest, right? Let's ask a question like this. In 1947, you have a lot of Jews living in Eretz Yisrael. There is no Jewish government, but there's a lot of Jewish population, and they're deciding what to plant in their various pastures, and they're deciding to smuggle weapons and whatever else they're doing in the land. Was that a fulfillment of conquering the land?
No.
That's one no.
I assume conquest would have to do with control over, so because they don't have control over any centralized government, I'd say no.
Okay, you need control and governmental control. Why do you need governmental control?
Because governments legitimize the use of force.
Governments legitimize the use of force. Okay, we're in a poli-sci seminar now. no, it's a good question, right? They legitimize the use of force. I mean, it seems from the last line in that Rambam that this mitzvah legitimizes the use of force. I'm allowed to use a milchama, a war, to conquer the land. And it seems like before I've conquered the land, I still have the right to use the force to conquer it. So I somehow have some authority to launch a war to conquer some parts of the land. That's what it sounds like.
But
not everyone agrees with this text. Like, if you ask the Arabs, they're going to say, we have the whatever they would call a mitzvah, to conquer this land and kill all Jews. That was their original
jihad.
That was their original, what's the...
Their land?
It's called the jihad when the...
The term for their
scripture?
Yeah.
The Quran?
No,
or the Hadith?
Not that. Like, their mission statement.
Okay.
It was their mission statement, kill every Jew. That's not a legitimate... To us, it's not a legitimate...
I agree with you that to us it is not a legitimate...
So, for us to just wage war on the basis of a mitzvah is not...
Okay, so you're asking a great question, or implying a great question. It wasn't phrased as a question, but that's okay. Which is, on what grounds do we, you know, wage war for the purpose of conquering territory? It's one thing to talk about a self-defensive war, but for the purpose of a land, I mean, seems like a more challenging kind of mitzvah than maybe ones that we're used to. I'm going to deliberately, if it's okay, kind of bracket off that question, because we can approach it and figure out, well, what are Jewish war ethics? What is required of us in a war? To what extent are we allowed to use force? What kind of force are we allowed to use? Those are all great questions. I thought about going that direction for the topic today, and it felt a little bit too on the nose. And I don't want to be sitting here like pontificating about the current IDF and their current choices. It's a valuable set of questions, though, and I am happy to talk about it either after another session, next semester, etc. But I'm going to try to push that off for the moment, if that's okay. But I agree that it's a significant question worth considering. We'll take the Ramban at his word right now that more war could be included in this mitzvah. Okay, I'm going to flip a question on you, a different question. Imagine Israel that is totally controlled by Jews, but no Jews live there. It's like parts of Florida, probably, that are like empty during parts of the year. But like Jews own all the property.
Great Britain prior to giving it over to the Jews?
Great
proxy.
Yeah, sure, right? Like, there might not be British citizens in the land, but, you know, technically the British Empire has the authority there.
No, that's...
Is that a fulfillment or no?
No.
Why not?
Because we still don't have control of it, in the sense that if, like, we don't have an army, and there's just Jews living there, that's, like, what's stopping the Arabs from going in and doing what they just did last week.
Right, so you're saying, if I'm understanding you correctly, that there's, like, legitimate force in the sense of, you have there's control in, like, the legal, theoretical sense. Like, I have a government, and they theoretically have the rule of law. And then there's authority in the real sense. Like, at the end of the day, someone has to be on the ground to participate. Which means, if I'm understanding you correctly, that the reason that people need to live in Israel, at least some people need to live in Israel, is in order that the land should be controlled by us.
Yes.
Okay, that's a possibility. That's a perspective. I'm not totally sure it's the Ramban's perspective, but it might be. And we'll see as he describes it in the next couple of paragraphs. So you picked up on... Right, I didn't read the pasuk closely, but there are two pieces of that pasuk. And I think you get that sense in the Ramban. We'll jump to the third paragraph in a moment. The pasuk that's quoted in the Ramban in the second line is, V'horeshtem et ha'aretz, you will inherit or inhabit the land. V'yishavtem ba, and you will live in it. So... You could have said, those are two different mitzvahs. Like, there's one mitzvah to live in the land, I don't care who's in charge, and another mitzvah to control the land, I don't care who's living in it. And they're two independent mitzvahs, and like, any Jew in the, I don't know, 1,500 years, 2,000 years between the destruction of the Second Beit HaMikdash, or the end of the Bar Kokhba revolt, or wherever you want to cut it off, and the 19th, 20th century, was not fulfilling one mitzvah, but they were getting the other. But what we're suggesting now is that even living in the land is just a way to achieve control. And until you really have control, you haven't fulfilled the mitzvah, necessarily. And maybe on the flip side, you know, we all live here, right? We're all in Chicago. But let's assert that, broadly speaking, Jews have a substantial amount of control in Israel right now. So are we fulfilling the mitzvah?
No.
Why not? There are Jews, they control the land. And there are a lot of Jews living in the land, so they actually control the land.
Yeah, we don't control all of it.
Okay, so maybe...
We don't control all of it. All right,
so then if you're living there but not participating in the government, then you're also not controlling it.
But, yeah, I mean, you are a little bit. Like, you have your house, and you control your house, and if you're in the...
The government can't control your house if you're not there.
Yeah, so I'm saying if you're living there, let's say you're living there and you're just a regular citizen and you don't vote and you don't, but you're like there.
Well, not
you're on the ground.
Well, not voting, and if you live in Eretz Yisrael, not voting has nothing to do with actually filling the mitzvah of each of ours or conquering the land. It's like just because you don't vote, like you still have, you're still fulfilling the mitzvah of each of ours. I would even go as far to say anyone who went to yeshiva or seminary for a year or year and a half, 2 years, whatever it is, you still fulfilled the mitzvah by living there.
Okay,
maybe,
so
maybe you didn't. Like,
is this like a group mitzvah, like a mitzvah that all of the Jewish people get, if you know?
Right. Okay.
Two people live there, and they have a government.
Right, so that's a fantastic question. Right? Imagine for the moment Israel was totally empty and I walked in and I said, I am now the prime minister of Israel. And I voted for myself and no one voted against me, so I'm the duly elected prime minister of Israel. Maybe I have fulfilled the mitzvah on some communal level. And then we work out the details. But the question as I understood it, which I think is a great question, is this a private mitzvah or a communal mitzvah? So, if I told you the mitzvah is to conquer or exert political control over the land, your first instinct?
It's gotta be communal.
It's gotta be communal. What does it mean to be an individual who conquers and has dominion over a land? Like, that's like almost a meaningless statement.
Yes, you must become a lord.
Right, so again, you could say, you know, I walk in and I assert control, and other people say, that's very nice. Goodbye.
Those aren't real, you know.
Now, there's another angle, which the Ramban adds, and we have to try to flesh out whether it's part of the same mitzvah or not. We'll jump to the third paragraph. The second paragraph is where the Ramban says, so you might think that once you've destroyed all the seven nations, you know, and that's historically back in the, you know, period of Yoshua, we're destroying the seven nations. Once you do that, we could go to Uganda and start a nation there. And that, people had that idea. You start the Uganda plan. When I was a camp counselor, one of the summers, each bunk was named after like an early Zionist figure, and one of the bunks was named Herzl. And so their chant the whole summer was, Uganda, Uganda. This was like a Zionist B'nai Akiva camp, and the messaging did not get across. So, but Herzl, okay, you know, as long as we have a country that Jews run, it doesn't really matter where in the world it is. Ramban's telling you no. Like, the mitzvah is inhabit the land of Israel, and not any Jewish land. It's not have a country, it's have this country.
Inhabit the land that God gave us.
Exactly. It's our land, not any land that we happen to take control over. That's very important. But the third paragraph is where you get this idea.
The land we're standing on right now is the Indians.
So the question is,
why do we control it? Why do we possess it? Why are they not in the central government? Why are they not?
Okay, so I think your question is presuming that just like God gave us our land, he also gave every other nation their land. Mm-hmm. Which might be the case. You might be able to go through Tanakh and see that theme, that God sort of assigns lands to different nations. It's a possibility. And then the question is, even if that's true, to what extent is it our responsibility to, like, fight for those claims? It could be. It's not our job. Like, the other nations will sort it out amongst themselves, and they'll fight about it, and they have, and they will continue to do so. And in the meantime, we have a responsibility to our land, and we're not here to, like, legislate every other nation and how they relate to each other. But that gets a little bit to, like, what is our national role in the world, which also gets, you know, hits those big questions. But it's a good one. Different countries also, it's worth noting, do things differently. Like, my wife's from Australia. We visited Melbourne 2 summers ago. And there, the culture is very, like, we pay lip service, you know, we, you know, honor the ancestors whose land we inhabit, and we, you know, honor and respect their, you know, tribal leaders, et cetera, et cetera. And there's a formula that people say. And it's much more at least aware of that fact than I think Americans tend to be. So that's an interesting historical note to note. But we're going to return to the mitzvah and the Ramban for a second. And here, it seems to, you know, diverge dramatically from everything we just said. We were talking about a communal mitzvah to conquer the land and exert political control, and all of a sudden, va'omer ani, I have this great idea, says the Ramban, ki a mitzvah shechachamim afligim ba v'hidir et Eretz Yisrael. The mitzvah that all sorts of rabbinic texts praise. You've got to live in Israel. If you live outside of Israel, it's like you're worshiping Avodah Zarah. It's a tremendous mitzvah to live in Israel, etc., etc. This is the end of the second line of that third paragraph. Hakol humi mitzvah aseh hazeh. It's all part of this mitzvah to inhabit the land and dwell in it. Im kein, therefore, he mitzvah aseh ledorot. It is an eternal mitzvah. It's not a one-time deal. It keeps happening over and over. Mitchayev kol yachid mimenu. Each of us is individually obligated in it. So all of a sudden, it's a private individual obligation. That's kind of interesting. The afilu bizman galut. And we raised the question before, does that mitzvah apply at all times? Ramban says, yes. Even during exile, when we don't have that national control, there's still a private mitzvah to live in the land of Israel. It's called Dira Eretz Yisrael, or Yeshivat Eretz Yisrael. So there's not Yerusha Ta'aretz, inheriting the land. There's also dwelling in the land that's also included in this mitzvah, according to the Ramban. And we already alluded to the possibility, well, maybe it's all part of that, achieving that broader goal. So each of us individually has a responsibility to live in the land, because each of us doing so builds towards that communal fulfillment. And you can't have a communal fulfillment without everyone individually doing their part. That's a possibility. Or, as we suggested, it could be two separate mitzvahs entirely. You could be a Zionist living in Israel in, you know, the 1400s, and it's under the Ottoman Empire, probably, or the Byzantine Empire, and you're good. You're fulfilling one mitzvah. Not both, but one, and one is good enough. And those two motifs, I think, are going to be really important. If there's going to be one kind of major takeaway from the Ramban, it's this kind of two-part mitzvah, or two aspects of a mitzvah, which is to inherit the land in some broader sense of control and authority that's a little more political and a little more communal. And then on the other hand, this private individual mitzvah of living in the land, which I fulfill on my own, doesn't matter what anyone else in the world is doing, I could still get that connection to the land. And it's by that kind of dual measurement that we're going to try to look at some different practical cases, some ways to fulfill Yishuv Eretz Yisrael, and see whether they really meet either of those standards, or both of those standards. And we'll trickle those down. I see the question, just one more note in the context of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael, that just to be clear about the broader picture. So I mentioned before that this work is the Ramban's arguments about the mitzvah that the Rambam left out. That leads to a really important question about the mitzvah of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael. If it's a really a very important mitzvah, why'd the Rambam leave it out? Why do you need to like add the footnote in the Rambam's list of all the mitzvahs saying, by the way, you forgot to include this mitzvah that's really important? So there's discussion, does the Rambam think it's a mitzvah at all? Maybe he thinks it's a rabbinic mitzvah, not a biblical mitzvah, or a general mitzvah, but not one that involves specific actions, etc., etc. There's a whole amount of literature on this. And it's worth noting that the Ramban is one very prominent voice, but not the only voice. There are even Rishonim who think that the mitzvah does not apply during exile. So long as Hashem hasn't brought us back into the land, we don't have a right to go and enter the land, right? That's what we now think of as like a Satmar position or an Ituri Karta position. So there are echoes of that in some earlier sources. They, you know, we can't enter the land until God brings us back. Or Rishonim think that on practical grounds, you know, it's too dangerous to go to Israel. It's too difficult to live in Israel. It can't be a mitzvah nowadays. It can only be a mitzvah under better political circumstances. So Ramban is going to be kind of the mainstream yardstick, but we should know that there's a little bit of variety around that approach and a little bit of a range surrounding that. We had a question, and then we'll move on to the practical applications so outside of Israel.
Just to like touch on what you were just saying,
please.
With like some groups in sects within Judaism that think we have to wait until Mashiach comes to be able to go and take it or Israel. There's a Gemara in Subas Kofiud Alf or Amud Beis somewhere.
Ooh,
there.
Is that source number two? I don't
such
know.
spoilers. Yeah.
This is just one excerpt of that Gemara, but what are you referring to in particular?
So it just says that we don't have a right to like assert a state until at least before Mashiach comes. Like we don't have a
right
to set up a government and set up a, you know, quote unquote state.
Yeah. Yeah, so there is a Gemara like that. The Gemara says that God made, you know, sort of imposed three oaths upon the world based on a pasuk in Shir HaShirim, and one of those oaths is that the Jewish people should not sort of en masse rise up and enter Eretz Yisrael.
I feel like that's sort of a
What you might mean in a more charitable spirit is that it's in a goddess of Gemara. And so even if you really take that Gemara, you know, it means what it sounds like it means, which you could debate. You can still say, okay, that's a nice agadata, right? Chazal say lots of things in non-legal contexts, but okay, like, I'm a halakhic Jew, and I believe there are formal mitzvahs, so you have your agadatas, and they're very nice, but my mitzvah says I have to go. So figure out how to read the agadata if you want, but I care about halakha. So there is such a view, and it is taken by, you know, the Satmar Rebbe as the most prominent figure. Some think that's what the Rambam means, probably not, but you have that voice. I think it's more mainstream if you ask people, you know, in a practical halacha sense, like, is there a mitzvah to live in Israel? Do I have to live in Israel? Some people will tell you yes. I have an uncle who lives in Israel, who's very passionate about the fact that he lives in Israel, and very passionate about the fact that I don't live in Israel, and is working on that problem. So we'll see if he's successful. We'll see if that becomes successful at some point. You see, this is what I should tell him, right? Like, there's an answer to this problem. it's very simple, but and some people will tell you it's
depends where you live.
Some people, others will tell you it's not a obligatory mitzvah. It's more like a mitzvah kiyumit. It's like a good fulfillment. You get a mitzvah if you do it, but you don't lose a mitzvah if you don't. Right? A good model for this is like, okay, think of when you hear the word charity, right? So the way people write to the word charity often is, if you give charity, that's really great. And if you don't give charity, you're not like a terrible person. You haven't lost so much by not giving. It's just really good if you do. Or people who like donate organs, right? No one, very few halachists will tell you it's a chiyuv to donate a kidney. Like, everyone go right now and you're chayav to sign up for the registry. But certainly it's a very nice thing if you do. It's not such a bad thing if you don't. So some people think of aliyah in those terms. It's great if you do it. If you don't do it, okay. That's also okay. But we should have what to aspire to, even if not everyone gets to that standard. That's on the sort of ideal level. But that's not the level we're working on, right? Because we're talking about people who live in Chicago and probably will for the foreseeable future, at least, you know, in the immediate sense. And so, you know, we have this, as reflected in our image on the first page, this sort of Israel attachment also with a Chicago attachment. It took me like 7 rounds on Dali to get an image that puts a Jewish star next to a Chicago flag star. I did not know why it was so difficult to do.
They did it with the American flag. The American flag just blends into the Israeli flag.
So I'm sure they're able to do it. I don't know why it took like a very advanced AI. I did use AI. I used Dolly, and Dolly took 7 tries to get an Israeli star next to a Chicago star. I don't know why. But we're in this place.
Of course it does.
Now it does.
Yes, it does.
Yeah, it does.
This
is ChatGPT's like younger sibling, Dolly, who knows how to make images. So I don't know, are they the same technology? Are they different technology?
They just know how to lie really convincingly. It's all AI does.
You know, it does make me sad because like we trained AI on people. So like if it knows how to lie really convincingly, I wonder where it learned it. That's like makes me sad.
It looks at the previous word and guesses what comes next.
We talked about AI, and we're going to talk about AI again later in the semester, sometime in December, so put a pin in that one as well. We're pinning up a whole corkboard right now. Okay. So three areas practically of the things that might or might not be the mitzvah of living in Israel. And we'll kind of evaluate each one individually. First one. You've heard this before. This is source number 2. Kol ha-mahalich arba amot be'eretz Yisrael. Anyone who walks 4 cubits in Israel, muftach lo shu ben olam haba. He is assured to be a ben olam haba. He's assured a place in the world to come. Is walking 4 amot in Israel a fulfillment of the mitzvah of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael?
Sure. Where is that?
No. That's a very confident yes. That's a Gemara. It's a piece in the Gemara, source number 2.
It's also a Rambam, I think. It's somewhere in Sefer, end of Sefer.
That would be a very generous definition.
It would be very generous. Why would it be a generous definition?
Score,
right? This is when every time I visit Israel, someone will tell me this, and they'll say, okay, so like, obviously that means you have to go on a walk now, right? If someone told you you're going to get Olam Haba, all it takes is walking, I don't know, 6 steps, I would spend the whole time walking. Why would I ever take a nap? Like, I should spend the whole time walking around the country. People tell me this. I'm not sure it makes that much sense. So, does it stack is a great question. It doesn't say every 4 amot you get. It says anyone who walks 4 amot. So you should go once. You should take a walk around the block. You should fly home, and you're good. And forget all the other mitzvahs. You got Olam Haba locked in. But why would that be a generous definition of what counts as Yishuv Eretz Yisrael? Yishuv is dwelling, not walking. Okay, that's part one, right? This is like an action-based thing. You're supposed to walk around, whereas the way the Ramban was describing the mitzvah is more about, like, your whole essence. Like, do you live somewhere? It's hard to know when you live somewhere. This is like in Sukkot, this is like an issue, right? Because the mitzvah in Sukkot is to live in the sukkah. But we don't really know what that means, so we say instead, you have to eat in the sukkah, or sleep in the sukkah, or whatever you want to do in the sukkah. But those are all, like, proxies. Because the real essence is just, like, live in it. And it's hard to know when you've done that. So we could say live in it means walk around in it. But that's not so simple, that live in it should mean walk around in it. Anyone going to try to defend it? Like, this is the mitzvah to live in Israel? Or why it might be? This is something the Israeli government...
I don't think that everyone's fit to live in Israel. I know that I'm not. I couldn't live there. I know that for a fact. I tried it for a year. No. So I'll take the mitzvah that I can get, if I can get it, and if not, then I'll suffer the consequences. But of course I'd rather believe that I'm getting Olam Haba because I went on that hike, you know?
Okay, right, so...
Why would I choose to believe something more, like, negative?
Okay, so you might be asking me, like, as a philosopher, like, epistemologically, why would you choose this belief? You probably don't mean that. What you probably mean is we have a religious feeling or religious incentive to want to expand the mitzvah as much as possible, especially as people who are not currently living there. We're looking for ways to be connected, and we're looking for ways to get parts of these mitzvahs, and so we should try to think broadly about the kinds of things that we might want to include. And there's... As with many things, there is a bit of a debate about this. I would argue, and we could... we'll skip the sources here, because there are other more interesting ones in the other sections, and we'll do that. It might be a bit of a debate between sources 3 and 4, the Rivash and the Maharit, these are different Rishonim, about whether walking around in Israel is really a mitzvah at all, or whether it's just like a nice chus. Like, if you get to do it, it's very nice. People nowadays say the word Indian. There's like an Indian of it. I don't know what that means exactly. That's a very... vague language, but it's nice to walk around in Israel. That's the Maharit's view in source number 4. The Rivash maybe thinks that traveling to Israel is a bit more of a mitzvah. That could be. And it has one possible really interesting nafgamina, which is alluded to in sources 5 and 6. And these are actually worth seeing. This is a halachic consequence of this debate. Right? So the debate is traveling to Israel and hanging out in Israel a fulfillment of this mitzvah? So that might impact the following question. The Shulchan Aruch in source number 5 talks about a halakha that comes up in the Gemara on Shabbos about when you're allowed to start a journey that you know is going to go on Shabbos. So you want to travel from here to Israel, but there are no planes because, I don't know, planes disappeared in this fictional scenario, but there are boats.
Or because it's before planes?
Or, fine, good, before planes is better. This is back in time. This was in the era before planes, the year 1800 BPE, before plane era. And you want to go to Israel, so you want to take a boat. Okay, but if I get on a boat today, I'm probably going to break Shabbos in the next 7 days, depending on what day I go. So am I allowed to start that journey knowing I'm going to break Shabbos a few days from now? So the Gemara assumes, and the Halacha simply, the Shulchan Aruch assumes, that for a normal journey, you're not allowed to take a journey starting on the Wednesday before Shabbos. So if it's Sunday, you're not even thinking about Shabbos. I mean, I start thinking about Shabbos like Thursday night when I go shopping, and we're going to, you know, Shabbos is not so much on my radar starting Sunday, Monday. So Sunday, Monday, you can take a journey, and if you have to break Shabbos 5-6 days from now, so you have to break Shabbos 5-6 days from now. And that's as a trickle-down consequence.
Isn't it not breaking Shabbos being on a boat?
So...
Because people did it in the 1800s or whatever. They would take boats to go to Israel to go to... seminary and yeshiva, and it took like 19 days.
So, is being on a boat on Shabbos a violation of Shabbos?
So it's not.
Is a fair question.
The best.
So there are two possibilities, right?
You're not getting on Shabbos. So you're still on a machinery, a piece of machinery. That's
okay. At best, it's a
they
machinery.
Did it.
Okay, one possibility.
Because they did it doesn't mean it was right. Doesn't mean that was the only what? Thing that's. Rabbis, you can't base
that's not like
that they
like
would prove did it based on the fact that they did it.
Right, so there is another, you know, just we're making the mosaic now in the corkboard of all the things we're putting pins in. Okay, so the way you're framing the question is only getting on or getting off the boat is a violation of Shabbos, and being on the boat is not. One major concern that Poskim raise, and I'm not here to litigate that question is there's a halakha called a tum. A tum means the area around your dwelling where you're allowed to travel on Shabbos. So you need to think of a good example because all of our cities are very interconnected. What?
A boat would be a tum.
Yes, but the boat would probably move a very substantial amount over the course of Shabbos. It would likely move from the moment Shabbos starts. You kind of have your area you're allowed to be in on Shabbos, and then you have a certain distance in every direction where you're allowed to travel.
It's like 2,000 amot.
2,000 amot, exactly, in every direction. And is it a square? How do you draw the shape, etc.? Okay. The boat probably will travel more than
2,000
amot is like less than a mile. Right, your boat is going further than that on Shabbos. So it could be that traveling that far is a violation of Shabbos. And then the question, you know, there are questions of, okay, given that that's the case, am I allowed to be on the boat at all? Is it my fault if the boat's moving but I'm not? The boat's the one taking me out, so I'm not. What if non-Jews are driving the boat? All of these are good questions. Really, the halakha is described is not actually about boats. It's about a caravan traveling through the desert with the idea that you're going to have to travel through the wilderness to get out in order to stay safe. But in any case, the premise here is, depending on when you start the journey, it might be prohibited to start or not. The Shulchan Aruch adds a detail. If you want to go up to Israel, Ha'olah le'Eretz Yisrael, in the third line of source number 5, then even if the journey is going to start on Erev Shabbos, you can still get on start that journey. And if you need to bring Shabbos later, so you bring Shabbos later. But that's not something you have to worry about now, because going up to Israel is a valuable enough mitzvah that you're allowed to start a journey before Shabbos in order to go there. A modern analog to this halakha would be like...
You're going to be there on the boat during Shabbos regardless of when you go.
So we could pick a different example that may work this way. Can I fly on Friday when there's like a chance that my flight will get delayed and I'll end up flying on Shabbos or landing on Shabbos?
You can take a flight and... You could take any other flight that's not on Friday. Let's say
this is the only flight available for the foreseeable future. All the planes disappeared but one. You were Orville Wright, as well as Orville Redenbacher, who it was not, decidedly. But Orville Wright, and he made a plane, and he said, you can take this plane to Israel, but if not, I'm going to give it to Elon Musk and he'll go fly to the moon or something. This is a very interesting hypothetical scenario.
There's so many things wrong with that sentence. I think it would have been better if it was Redenbacher.
That's all right. It's fine. So, my only opportunity to go to Israel, but it risks bringing Shabbos. So Shulchan Aruch says, you could go. Now, the Magen Avraham in source number 6 adds the following caveat, based on this debate that we saw in sources 3 and 4. Does this leniency only apply for going to move to Israel? Or only if you're going to visit? Well, it will depend on exactly this question. If just walking around Israel and visiting Israel is a fulfillment of the mitzvah, so yeah, you could take the boat or the caravan to Israel. And if you need to break Shabbos, you'll break Shabbos, because going to Israel and being there is a mitzvah. However, according to the other view, the view of the Maharet, that it's not really a mitzvah, and really the mitzvah is only to dwell in Israel, so then you only get the leniency if you're making aliyah and you're moving. But if you're not moving, so who cares? It's very nice that you're going to walk around Israel and you'll have a beautiful tiyul and it will be lovely, but it's not a mitzvah. And that's not enough of a reason to risk breaking Shabbos. So that debate in, you know, what counts as a mitzvah has some Hilchos Shabbos consequences, as is our next example. So that was, I think, the least plausible case, right? If walking around in Israel is going to count as living in Israel, great. But it's a little controversial. It doesn't seem so likely that would fit either the definition of conquering the land. My walking around in Israel doesn't seem to fit the bill. And even for living in Israel, it's hard to say that walking around in Israel is the same as living in Israel. But let's take another example, which is starting in source number 7, our second case, purchasing property in Israel. I'm going to give you a home run proof that that's a big mitzvah. This is Gemara in Gittin. The Gemara in Gittin says, I'll summarize it outside in the interest of time. It says that the land of Syria, parts of modern-day Syria, is considered halachically like the land of Israel for the following case. If someone comes to you and says, I own a plot of land in Israel, I would like to sell it to you, but it's Saturday, and I'm going to leave... you know, in the next couple of hours. So you can't push this deal off till after Shabbos. We have to make the deal right now. The Gemara here, in source number 7, bottom of page 3, top of page 4, says, I can't write a legal document on Shabbos for that. That's a violation of a halacha in the Torah. A biblical mitzvah doesn't override this halacha. But I can ask a non-Jew to do it for me, which would normally be a rabbinic prohibition of a mir la'akum. You can't ask non-Jews to do malacha for you on Shabbos. Obviously, there are a million exceptions and limitations
time.
On the rule, and et cetera, et cetera. But
directly, you can't tell them to.
Right.
But we can have them.
I can't tell.
Ah, so okay, let's use that. I could directly go to an Anju and say, "Please write this document for me, so that I could buy this house on Shabbos."
You can't say that.
The Gemara in Gittin says I can. Because I'm buying a house in Israel.
Oh, buying it, okay.
And buying a house in Israel because of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael, that overrides this Derabanan Mitzvah, this rabbinic prohibition of not asking an Anju to do work for you on Shabbos. I'm allowed to buy a property in Israel. Great. Okay, is buying property in Israel a fulfillment of either aspect of the Mitzvah of living in Israel?
According to some, yes.
Oh, it's a machloket. Of course it is. But let's try to think it out. Why should it count? Why might it count?
If you have control of it, buying it is a method of conquering, just financially.
Buying is a method of conquering. I have the right to decide what happens on this land now. And because I bought the land, presumably people in Israel will protect my property from someone who wants to trespass on it or do something else with it. It's mine. I have the right to decide what's going to happen with it. So, I fulfill conquering. Do I fulfill living?
Yes.
Even though I never visit, I have a vacation home in Israel, but I don't...
100%.
Interesting.
To the point that there is... very strict opinion, it's not the majority of you, and so I don't think we hold like this, that it's in regards to whether you hold 1 day or 2 day yontiv. There's an opinion out there that says you can only hold 1 day yontiv in Eretz Yisrael if you own a property in Eretz Yisrael. In other words, people...
So if you're living and don't own property there?
Yeah.
So okay,
I live in...
Oh, the modern economy.
Yeah, so anyone who is renting an apartment but lives there, according to this one opinion, would have to hold 2 day. It's not in a majority view, obviously, but...
But what you're describing is someone who both lives in Israel and has property. I'm talking about someone who might not live in Israel and have property.
I'm talking about someone who has a property there, who bought a home or an apartment there, and okay, like... He, let's say, lives here, but he just uses it to go on vacation for Sukkot, or Pesach, or whatever, whenever he wants.
Okay.
Plenty of families.
So what I'm hearing then, if I'm understanding you right, is that whatever it means to live in a place, you definitely live there more if you own property. Right? If I'm just visiting Israel, every time I go to Israel, I buy a hotel or rent a hotel room... That's not living in Israel.
No.
Whereas if every time I go to Israel, I go to my vacation home, I'm definitely living there more.
Right, but then it comes down to...
Where do you draw the line about exactly what it means to live?
More.
How do you establish Palestinian residency?
That is basically the question we're debating right
now.
So
can you bring...
If I own the property...
Israel and...
You don't need to. Everyone in Israel lives in RVs. No, obviously a lot of people don't, but a lot of the small yishuvim, all these small habitations, a lot of them are RV-based, at least in the beginning, until you build property there. So, is buying property in Israel going to fulfill this bit? It sounds like, from the perspective of inhabiting the land, and conquering it, and having dominion over it...
Pulling myself from your horrible joke with a cookie.
It probably should. Even from the perspective of living there, maybe it does. You could debate exactly whether it should or shouldn't. And low, we mentioned before, is probably a debate. And indeed, sources 8, 9, etc., kind of flesh out this debate. One note I just have to add as part of this picture, and it's worth looking at sources 8 and especially 9, because in source number 9, the Avnei Nezer suggests that in order to live somewhere, we ask what counts as halakhic residence. Part of it means you get your sustenance there. So imagine if I am in yeshiva in Israel, and I live there for a couple of years, but I'm living on my parents' bank account, which low is what many people do when they go after high school. They're mostly not making their own money. They're mostly being supported. Avnei Nezer says, that's not as much living in Israel, right? To live in a place means to get your livelihood in that place.
So
owning property is one part of it. Getting a livelihood is another part of it. It's hard to say that if you're just getting wired money from overseas, that you're really...
So then according to this opinion, like anyone who's in full and is in... So, and is being supported by their in-laws or their parents are in America.
So that obviously is correct, according to that view that he's proposing. And it's not exactly clear where he lands on that at the end, but according to that thesis, you're right. They would not be considered to be living in Israel in the full sense of the word. Mm-hmm. Maybe partially, but not fully.
Would this also apply to like your population that are like earning their livelihood in America having the money transferred?
So that's a great question, because the modern economy is very different than the economy. The Avnei Nezer is the 19th century. The Sacheverry is the 19th century. He was living in an economy where money was a lot more local, right? You weren't necessarily being wired money in the bank by your company that you work for just overseas. It's hard to imagine that he would say that because your paycheck is paid by an American company, that means it doesn't count as livelihood from being in Israel. But it's hard to know, because he didn't even have this comprehension that, like, you'd make money from clicking a bunch of keys on a keyboard. Like, it's a weird notion, right? So it's hard to know.
I think the easiest way to income, like, the source of income is definitely from the U.S., but it's interesting because you're definitely living there.
And you're earning money there.
But if you're farming there and selling your crops overseas, why would that be any different?
So that's true. There is much more obvious that you're getting the thing from the land.
But where's the distinction? All right, if you're doing art, making art there, and then selling it to clients in Europe, what would be the difference in that?
That's true. That's a good point.
I think what matters, from what I'm understanding of this, is doing work in Israel is the distinction, not just being funded and living there.
Right, so that seems more persuasive. The language is much more focused on, like, where your income is in that Avnei Nezer in source number 9. But you're right that it might not be so crisp in, like, a modern economic sense, especially. Right, when most people are farmers, so it's very easy to draw the line between where your sustenance is from. Are you getting food from here, or are you being given food from elsewhere? But in a more complex economy, these things become a little bit more difficult to tease out, which is what I'm sensing. And I think you're right, that it's not so simple to apply this standard.
Why we're not China.
There are many reasons why we're not China right now.
If we went by that logic, all the corporations that make up America would be considered Chinese,
right,
and we would be considered living in China.
Right. You wonder, like, if I'm producing income, you know, mental income, let's say.
No, I'm saying Apple.
Oh, you have an
iPhone.
And it would be a fun exercise one day to, like, look around the room and see how much of the stuff that we're surrounded by is, like, American versus Israeli versus elsewhere.
I mean,
fascinating activity.
Well,
or do you want to care about intellectual output? You're right. You're right. These are interesting questions. We have a few minutes left, so I just want to lock down one, and I think the most promising of the consequences. So we had one possibility of being in Israel, traveling, tourism. Maybe that'll count, but it's not as obvious. Buying property seems a lot closer. You're getting more authority and control in the place. Though, source number 10 argues, the Piskei Tshuva adds this caveat, one second, that might only apply if you buy from non-Jews. But if I buy a house from another Jew, so there is no greater Jewish dominion in the land because of that. It's just different Jews control the land. But that doesn't change anything.
That's assuming that he was bought against all to a Jew.
I'm protecting the land from being sold and removed from Jewish control. Okay, that's true. Right. That seems right to me. So that is adding that extra caveat. And the most promising example, I think, is the example in the third section. So starting with source number 12, supporting causes of Israel. So there's a whole debate. I think Rabbi Goldstein, who's the assistant rabbi of Kins, is currently in the other room giving a shiur on this more fully. So anyone who wants to go and hear the full expanded version of this discussion is more than welcome.
He was a teacher like 2 years
ago. I know he led this group a couple of years ago. He was in the Kola last year as well. But there are principles in Tzedakah, and the conflict between these two principles is going to lead us to this following consequence. There's one principle in Tzedakah that giving to local causes takes priority. Aniyei irchak u'dmim, before I give to the Cleveland Chesed Fund, I should give to the Chicago Chesed Fund. It's my local community. There's another principle in Halacha that giving to causes in Israel takes priority over giving to causes outside of Israel. Aniyei Eretz Yisrael have a priority as well. And they're both learned from Psukim, and they're in source number 12, the Psukim that we learn each of these halachas from. So the question is, what happens when these two things conflict? Right? If you're in Israel, so then you could prioritize, Modi'in, where you live, over Beit Shemesh, where you don't. And if you're outside of Israel, and you can't give to causes in Israel, let's say, they're too far away, you don't know how to get money there, so prioritizing Chicago over Cleveland is pretty obvious. But what do you do when these two principles conflict? Do you have an answer?
Well, I mean, I have more of a question on your
on my
question.
Premise.
Like,
okay.
Yeah, I don't see why it has to conflict. I mean, if, like, we all know you have to give 10% of your like income to set up a MITRE. So if someone is making 180K a year here in America, so that works out to being $18,000 towards MITRE. So give, let's say, $5,000 towards the Chicago HESA fund, therefore you've got your priority taken here. Maybe it also talks about your family, if your family needs, like your in-laws, your parents,
okay,
whatever. So maybe $1,000 for them, whatever. Another $5,000, $7,000 or so towards funds and areas that are all donating for the army or whatever. Like, so you just, point is, you spread it out,
okay,
wide and thin.
So you're
far and wide.
Okay,
far
so,
wide.
Right, you're asking, do these really have to be in conflict? So I'll say there are two ways to, for me to justify this question. The first way to justify the question is to say, yeah, I'm not as rich as the hypothetical person in your scenario, so I don't have as much money to give, so I can spread it out as well, and in order to give something meaningful, I have to pick one. I have to either pick the foreigner or the local guy, and I don't have a choice because I don't have enough money.
Well, it's quality over quantity.
I mean, alternatively, the other way to motivate the question, and I think we could get to this question and appreciate what it's trying to hit at anyway, is to say, there are only two causes. I get a letter from the Chicago Chesed Fund, I get a letter from the Jerusalem Chesed Fund, and I get no other letters, and I don't know of any other poor people, and they each ask me for money. So, should I give exactly equal amounts to both? Should I give more to one cause? And if so, which cause do I get more to? Right? Let's make a clean, simple world where we could really just see these principles in tension with each other. Mm-hmm. So there's a debate that we see in the Akronim, in sources 13, 14, 15, etc. But the formulation I like the most, let's say in source number 14, is that giving to the poor in Israel takes precedence. Right? The Bach in source 13 says giving to your local poor takes precedence. In source number... the Bach actually disagrees with this. Hold on, I want to make sure I get the Bach right. Hold on a second. In source number 13... The Bach does say so. That if you have your local poor, you have to your local poor over sending to causes in Israel. But in source number 14, he argues, if you give to the poor of Israel, you fulfill two mitzvahs. You fulfill tzedakah, and you fulfill, last two words, three words, l'kayim yeshivat Eretz Yisrael. You fulfill the mitzvah of settling the land by supporting causes in the land. And this makes a great deal of sense by our two metrics. Is it the same as living in Israel? I would argue probably not. But is it fulfilling the idea of Jewish control and authority and inheritance of the land? I think definitely, right? On like the most basic level, you're supporting a poor person's ability to live in Israel and stay in Israel. If you support government causes or nonprofit causes, you're supporting a broader group of people and their ability to have authority or to live well in Israel. And you get that sense that you, even at a distance, our our tzedakah obligations have a role in fulfilling this mitzvah. Because again, if we really buy the Ramban, and if we really accept that Jewish authority and control and inheritance of the land is the key idea of the mitzvah, so certainly, I think it would be very uncontroversial to say you fulfill that mitzvah in that way. Maybe there's conflict about exactly what principle takes precedence, but certainly the idea that giving money can contribute to that cause on some level, I think, is more or less universally accepted. So if we want like the most practical, actionable takeaway, like that would certainly be one, and I think we're seeing a lot of appeals towards that given the contemporary context. But seeing in the context of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael adds like an extra layer of meaning to this, because we're also doing our part to contribute to the project called Zionism, the project called the Jewish State, and the project communally of this mitzvah of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael. And that's a tremendous thing to be able to be a part of, even from Chicago.
I think
the
last source of Bach is actually a really nice piece, because it's not everyone like here in America or Europe or whatever, maybe they want to, like, but they, for whatever like life circumstance they're facing, they can't.
Right.
Right. So, okay, so then I would say then they're putter from the mitzvah altogether. If, like, you have a legitimate thing that's going on, okay, you're putter from the mitzvah. But they still want to fulfill it, so then, according to this Bach, which I think pretty much rely on, it's hard to argue on the Bach.
Mm. And so it's really source 14. It's the Pe'at HaShulchan. I apologize, I wasn't clear about that before. Who really makes that argument very crystal clear? You fulfill the mitzvah of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael. Like,
well,
that's a one-liner you want to use? Take it. That's
Then you fulfill the mitzvah of Yishuv Eretz by just supporting Kollel or the IDF or whatever.
whatever cause it is. And it's not here for us to discuss what causes are the right causes right now, but the fact that you could remotely fulfill a mitzvah that involves living in a place is actually kind of wild also, because it's really about establishing like a broader sense of a Jewish presence for the things really meaningful. It's a Pe'ar HaShulchan, it's 14.
14. Which one are you now talking about, 15 or
2? Both 14 and 15 say similar things. You can take a look at the nuances between the two. The one last thing to note, this is like an interesting historical note, is that both Rav Yisrael ben Shmuel Ashkenazi of Shklov and the Pnei David, the Chida, were what's known as Shadar, Shlucha Derabanan. In other words, their job was to live in Israel and go around to all the communities in Europe and get funding to support the Yishuv. So it's a certain, like, they believe this idea, and this idea ends up motivating so much of their life and work, to the point where the Chida is like a world traveler, traveling, you know, all throughout North Africa, Europe. He ends up dying in Italy, raising the funds to fulfill the mitzvah that he thinks you get to fulfill by donating funds to Eretz Yisrael. So this is a beautiful, like, integration of Torah and life for these figures. Like, they believe this is a Yishuv Eretz Yisrael, and then they get to live that in the whole sense. They live in Israel, and they fundraise for Israel in the same sense.
Being buried in Italy and in Eretz Yisrael.
He isn't. He was moved to Eretz Yisrael. You're right. He was buried in Italy originally, and then they ended up moving his kever to Eretz Yisrael. Okay, that is.